Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, the Chemistry World Podcast.
Hello, welcome to the August edition of the Chemistry World Podcast with Chemistry World's editor Mark Peplow and science correspondents Victoria Gill, Richard Van Orden and James Mitchell Crowe. I'm Chris Smith. On the way, the high-tech approach to cleaning up polonium contamination in London.
They didn't want to be taking out whole bathtubs and whole toilets and whole wash basins and locking them up and burying them deep underground. So what they did was smash off all the contaminated enamel with hammers.
And the glow from those workers wasn't down to sweat either. Also, the Chinese have perfected the art of getting energy from a coal seam, but without lifting a pick or a shovel.
You can turn coal into a kind of fuel gas called syngas, a mixture of carbon monoxide and hydrogen. What it involves is pushing steam and air into a coal seam. And then at the other end of the coal seam, after this chemical reaction has taken place at nearly 1,000 degrees, you get syngas coming out.
And woe betide any hungry ladybirds planning to eat green flies feasting on cabbages, because these guys are into chemical warfare.
They take up a particular chemical that the cabbages produce called glucosinolates, and they store that away in their body. If they are attacked, they release an enzyme which breaks down the glucosinolate into mustard oil. So effectively, they're releasing a mustard oil bomb.
And the full story of how they do that's coming up shortly. Plus, we've got the answer to Ben's question from last month.
Hello, I'm Ben from Wolverhampton. I'd just like to ask, why is it that wood changes colour as it ages?
That's on the way, but first, it was bad news for bathtubs, sushi bars and Russian spies. I'm of course talking about polonium-210 and the diplomatic row that's now erupting over its use in London last year as a murder weapon. Only a tiny amount was used, but the clean-up has been far from trivial, Victoria.
The chemists that I spoke to were staying very much out of the diplomatic row, but they have revealed some of the techniques they used for the mammoth task that was cleaning up London.
But why was it such a big problem?
Well, there were 50 venues affected, restaurants, hotels, all civilian venues, and you don't really often get nuclear decontamination needed in civilian venues.
So when you say it's contaminated, how much was there? Was this registerable amounts of radiation coming out of these venues? And that, how much must that have been?
I'm not sure of the measurements, to be honest, but registerable. And it's very nasty stuff if you ingest it, but it's nasty enough that it needs completely getting rid of.
Because it makes alpha particles, doesn't it? So they presumably can't get to you very far through air. So
no.
That's why you're saying it's bad if you eat it.
Yeah, exactly, which is what happened to poor Mr. Litvinenko.
So what did they do to clean up London?
Several things that ranged from a bit of a wipe down to smashing up bathrooms. It was
Sounds radical.
The first thing they revealed was that most of the decontamination could be done with basic detergent. The solid, non-porous surface where fixed surface contamination is found can be wiped down with potassium hydroxide-based detergent. And the other thing was that because alpha particles are so weakly penetrating, they can't get through a layer of glass, a layer of paper, or a layer of varnish or paint. So quite often on these solid surfaces, they could be painted over or varnished to seal away the polonium-210.
Doesn't that mean it's still there, which means it's still a threat down the line if someone comes along with a paint stripper?
Well, no, because it has a very, very short half-life of about 130 days. So as long as these surfaces are left sealed from public contact, then it's perfectly safe.
And the bathtub?
Yes, this is pretty interesting. The representative from the Government Decontamination Service talked us through sort of different methods that they used. And one of the things was that if the polonium-210 had come into contact with a surface that wasn't solid and non-porous, then the polonium-210 can get within that substance.
So do bathtubs fulfil that remit there?
Well, exactly, yes. Ceramic or enamel on bathtubs and wash basins and toilets is a porous material. So the whole of that enamel-coated surface is contaminated with polonium-210, and that needs to be taken away. But because there was so much other contaminated waste to be removed, chairs and curtains and carpets and all of this absorbent stuff that had to be gotten rid of, They didn't want to be taking out whole bathtubs and whole toilets and whole wash basins and locking them up and burying them deep underground. So what they did was smash off all the contaminated enamel with hammers. It was as basic as that.
But one wonders if that treatment is going to make the stuff go up in the air.
Well, no,
this
it is.
Could lead to secondary contamination.
No, it is fixed within the substance that it's come into contact with.
Well, let's hope it stays there. But from one kind of mind-bending concept, smashing up bathtubs, to another, Richard, LSD is making a resurgence in terms of whether we think it might be useful for psychotherapy.
Well, we found that LSD, D-lysergic acid diethyl amide, as chemists would call it, its use in psychiatric therapy could be studied for the first time in almost three decades. There's going to be a trial in Switzerland to determine whether patients with anxiety relating to advanced stage illnesses or terminal illnesses can be safely given LSD to help them.
What's the motivation behind doing this? Why do we think it might be better than the other drugs that the market currently has? There are lots of drugs that can make people feel less anxious about things. Why LSD?
Well, I mean, reports of LSD use cite changes in how you feel about the world, and your experience on LSD can make you feel less anxious afterwards, so people say. Now, it's often thought that, you know, this is why LSD should be used in a medical setting. But back in the 1970s, when LSD was classed as a class one drug, which meant it had no medical use, all the research was stopped. And some of it trickled on into the 80s, but there was no actual legal research into the use of LSD on humans, which is why this is really so interesting.
And so when are they going to kick off? Is it getting the full green light action, or is there going to be more litigation and bureaucracy to get through yet?
It's had approval from a Swiss ethics committee, but to be fully started, it needs to get approval from Swissmedic, who are the Swiss Drug Regulation Authority. But the president of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies in the US, MAPS, they're sponsoring the study, and they reckon they are going to get approval from this committee by the end of the year, so it's that soon.
Do you think this is going to open the floodgates? Because there are lots of drugs which failed to find any kind of therapeutic benefit. They've become weak drugs of abuse. Do you think they're going to end up back in clinical trials of people looking for functions for these agents?
Well, there does certainly seem to be a core of therapists who are looking to try and find some use for these drugs. There are studies with ecstasy, with MDMA and DMT. And I think people at Harvard Medical School, as I remember, are trying to develop a study to look into the use of LSD to treat cluster headaches, just by asking people who've used psychedelics themselves to treat their cluster headaches.
So there is they think they're an aspirin, so their headache goes away.
So there is a certain sort of continuing stress on using these kinds of drugs.
So LSD might make a comeback, and not just amongst hippies. Thanks, Richard. Now, most of you will probably have sprayed your carpets, sofas, or even your loafers with Scotchgard, or perhaps you fry your full English in a Teflon pan. Well, they work fantastically, but there's a problem related to the chemicals that are used to make them. Here's Scott Mabry.
The problem is that the Arctic and humans are significantly contaminated with perfluorinated acids, perfluorinated carboxylic acids, perfluorinated sulfonic acids. How did that come to be is the question. Whether or not they are inherently toxic in humans, for example, is yet to be determined. But the concentrations are sufficiently high enough to warrant rather significant scientific and regulatory and then thus societal interest in, you know, where do these chemicals come from and how can we cut off exposure both to remote regions like the Arctic and to humans in particular.
What actually are they, Scott, and where do they come from?
They are long chain, meaning 8, 9, 10, 11 carbons with fluorine. All the carbons are bonded to fluorine only. And then we either have a carboxylic anion or a sulfonic acid anion on the end. They are surfactants. Some of them have been used in firefighting foams, some as processing aids in making other materials, Teflon, for example. The bulk of the more recent usage has been incorporating the perfluorinated tail into fabric coatings, paper coatings, things that we like to have the properties of water repellency and oils and stain repellency.
So what's the scale of the problem?
In the Arctic, high up in the food chain, polar bears, seals, the perfluorinated compounds are now either the most common pollutant or certainly vying for top pollutant status.
And in humans?
Pretty much every human blood sample tested, to my knowledge, has PFOS, perfluorooctane sulfonic acid, also known as Scotchgard, and PFOA, perfluorooctanoic acid, at a few to tens of micrograms per liter, part per billion. So relatively high concentrations.
But you can also find lots of other things washing around in people and polar bears that whilst they're there, they're not necessarily pathological. So is there any evidence that we should worry about these things?
Certainly the 3M Corporation, went in 2000, when they announced that they were pulling the 8-carbon version of Scotchgard, they did so on recognizing that these were ubiquitous, universal contaminants globally, that they were found in all human blood samples tested.
But what are people worried about? What do people think they might be able to do to the body, given that they're there?
I think the mechanisms of those kinds of actions are still being worked out. To me, much more of scientific interest is actually the root of exposure itself. Why do we have these things in our blood? And do they come from precursors that we metabolize or transform into the end products, like perfluorooctanoic acid? That is pertinent because if we're metabolizing a precursor, and the precursors we think are fluorinated telomer alcohols, then some of the intermediates along the way in that metabolic process are actually quite reactive and have the potential to be of quite toxicological interest.
And presumably these chemicals and the parent compounds are quite stable in the environment, which is why they've accumulated, which suggests that they could be a problem to clean up and get rid of.
Well, interestingly, it's the perfluorinated acids that are very stable. In fact, I've been quoted as saying they redefine persistence because of the persistent organic pollutants we know, DDT, PCBs. The perfluorinated acids have no known environmental degradation pathways. Thus, I can't give you a lifetime because it's so long that we can't measure it. The precursors themselves are actually much more labile. They are reactive in the atmosphere, in surface waters, in biology. Metabolically, we can convert them through intermediates into the perfluorinated acids that are so stable.
So given that stability, how can we get rid of them if we decide that we need to?
The problem with these compounds are that, to my knowledge, nobody has observed, under any relevant environmental conditions at all, any degradation. So I cannot tell you what would ultimately happen. I think the eventual fate of these probably would be sedimentation in the ocean.
So if we do discover that there is a health implication, that's a bit of a problem, isn't it?
I think if there is a health implication, then we have to look very closely at the roots of exposure, human exposure, and quickly identify how to shut off those roots of exposure.
The chemical that really isn't biodegradable, Toronto University's Scott Mabry. Well, from making a mess of the environment to a way to do things more cleanly, and the Chinese have now mastered the art of getting the energy out of coal without having to dig it up, Mark.
It's based on this idea that you can turn coal into a kind of fuel gas called syngas, a mixture of carbon monoxide and hydrogen. Now, this is technology that's been around for a long time. It's using the same sort of idea that they used to make coal gas in the 19th century for the early gas lamps. What it involves in this case is pushing steam and air deep down 100 metres below the earth into a coal seam. And then at the other end of the coal seam, after this chemical reaction has taken place at nearly 1,000 degrees, you get syngas coming out, carbon monoxide and hydrogen.
What actually is the chemical reaction that produces this?
Carbon atoms that are locked up in coal, you're reacting them with oxygen and with water to make CO, carbon monoxide, and H2, hydrogen gas.
And that then gets funneled off at the other end of the coal seam.
That's right. Once it comes out, you can use syngas for a variety of things. In theory, you could take away the carbon monoxide and just burn the hydrogen. But probably a more efficient way to use it is to actually use a process called the Fischer-Tropsch process, which turns this into liquid fuels. That makes it easier to use sort of existing pipelines and infrastructure and things like that to transport the fuel around. This is something that was tried in China both in the 60s and in the 80s. And one of the major problems was to actually make it work, you effectively had to make this vast chamber in the middle of the coal seam, almost like a big reaction vessel underground. And that obviously requires sending people underground, digging it out. This group, they're based in Jiangsu province, they've found a way to make this blast of steam and air burrow its own reaction vessel inside the coal seam. It effectively makes a pipe about half a metre wide.
Are all the coal seams actually amenable to this kind of, I want to use the word therapy for some reason, but what's the chances of the gas coming up somewhere else? It doesn't come out of your collector, it sort of finds other ways up to the surface.
It's certainly not amenable to every single coal seam that you've got. Basically, you have to alter the conditions depending on the geology locally. They spent quite a while sort of fine-tuning the temperature that they did this at, the amount of steam and the amount of air that they put down. But after a few months of optimization, they found that they were getting out hundreds of cubic metres of syngas every hour.
I suppose from an environmental point of view, it's much better because you're not sending people underground. You're not digging out tons of rock you then chuck away and contaminating the area. You're just getting the energy out.
That's right. In terms of the heating value, if you like, of syngas, it's about a quarter of natural gas. But like you said, you're not wasting lots of energy in sending people down, digging shafts. And also, 5,000 coal miners died in China last year in accidents. So it's potentially also a lot of lives saved.
And there's no risk of some kind of runaway reaction where the oxygen starts to burn off the coal and it goes out of control.
Well, it's very carefully controlled, and that's one of the things that they were really looking at in the study, was how you can control the rate of burn. Funnily enough, controlling it in that way is the key to getting the best quality gas out. So they've really fine-tuned that and got it down to the stage where they can keep the fire front moving through the seam at a very controlled, slow rate.
Sounds promising. Well, that's one seam that we'll certainly be hoping to plumb for more information in future. Now, James, what's all this about aphids, which are using chemical defences to ward off ladybirds?
Well, it could be bad news for your veggie patch, Chris. These cabbage aphids have hijacked the chemical defences of the cabbages to defend themselves against ladybirds, which eat the aphids.
What do they actually do?
Well, they take up a particular chemical that the cabbages produce called glucosinolates, which is basically a glucose molecule with a sulfur and nitrogen-containing side chain, and they store that away in their body. If they are attacked by a ladybird, they release an enzyme which breaks down the glucosinolate into volatile isothiocyanates, which are the major ingredient found in mustard oil. So effectively, they're releasing a mustard oil bomb to fend off the attack against the ladybird.
And why doesn't it harm the aphids?
Well, it does actually kill the aphid who produces the bomb, but what it does is protect the rest of the colony.
So it's like an aphid suicide bomber almost.
It is, yes. But the colonies of aphids reproduce asexually, so effectively they're all the same genetic material in there. So it doesn't affect the gene pool and it doesn't affect those genes' chance of reproducing because it protects the rest of the colony.
Do they continue with this behaviour throughout their life cycle, or do they switch it on when they most need it, when the ladybirds are most prevalent or something?
Well, they use this technique throughout the summer when they're feeding, but then when it comes to the autumn and the colony is dispersing to try and colonise new plants, the aphids grow wings, and so they can't afford the energy of keeping this chemical defence system going, so they basically shut that down to use the energy to grow wings, and then the ladybirds can get their revenge by feasting away to their heart's content.
The insects that really are what they eat. And now from life in the undergrowth to life on Mars, or at least a new NASA mission to find out whether anything ever did live there. I spoke with William Boynton about Phoenix, which is due to touch down next year and pick up where previous probes left off.
Several years ago, another instrument that we had built here at the University of Arizona called a gamma ray spectrometer had actually detected ice buried just beneath the surface. So this Phoenix lander is going to land in this area, dig up some of the soil that's covering the ice and grind into the ice to remove some samples, and we'll do a chemical analysis on those samples.
What are you going to be looking for, chemically speaking?
We're looking for a variety of minerals. Ice is certainly the most important one. First, the sample gets scooped up by a robotic arm and delivered to the instrument called TEGA, which stands for a thermal analyzer and evolved gas analyzer. And the thermal analyzer is essentially a very small oven, which is a calorimeter. So we heat up the sample and very carefully measure the heat it takes to raise the sample by typically 5 or 20 degrees a minute. And if there are things in the sample, for example, ice, once we run up past 0 degrees Celsius, we have to supply extra heat in order to melt the ice, which tells us, indeed, we must have had ice in the sample.
Is it just inorganic things you're able to look at with this, Bill, or will you be able to probe organic molecules that might be there too?
So far, I've only described half of the instrument, the thermal analyzer, but as the sample is heated up, any gases that are given off are passed through a thin tubing to the evolved gas analyzer, which is really a mass spectrometer. So we will be able to tell whether organic molecules are present or are not present.
So say you do strike oil, and I mean that in the perspective of finding past vestiges of life. What's the kind of chemical hallmark that tells you something was living here once?
We actually are not expecting to necessarily say whether something had been living there in the past or not. At this point, we are even wanting to find out if the conditions are such that organic molecules can survive. In the mid-70s, there was a mission called Viking, which went to Mars and did a similar experiment, except it wasn't in the polar regions, and they didn't heat the samples to such high temperatures, and they got a negative result saying there was essentially no organic molecules there. We're going to higher temperatures here, close to 1,000 degrees. What we're hoping for is that very refractory organic molecules that might have survived on Mars might have been missed by the Viking instrument, which only went to 500 degrees.
Also, are you getting deeper in beneath the surface? Are you scratching further beneath the surface than Viking might have done? Because it strikes me that if these things were living on Mars, if there were the kinds of things there that could have produced organic molecules, they're likely to be subsurface. Anything on the surface may have been destroyed by solar radiation.
Yes, we have the capabilities of digging substantially deeper than the Viking mission, but if we reach this solid ice layer 4 or 5 centimeters beneath the surface, we don't expect that we can dig very far into the ice. We can grind samples out of the ice, but we're actually hopeful that because it's in a polar region where it's colder, some things might actually get embedded in the ice where they might be protected.
What other experiments are aboard this Phoenix probe? What else will you be able to do with it?
Oh, there are a variety of other things. There's some cameras, of course, that are taking pictures of surroundings, as well as some microscopic imagers that'll look at particles. There's a meteorology package measuring temperature and pressure and wind speeds. The Canadians are providing a LIDAR, which is essentially a laser that looks up into the air and looks for presence of clouds and scattered light. And there's another instrument doing some wet chemistry where some of the soil is actually put into a little beaker. Water is added from Earth and stirred in various electrodes like pH electrode, which measures the acidity of the soils, and ion-specific electrodes that can tell how much salt might be present in the sample. So it's a pretty comprehensive suite of instruments that are going there.
And there's no way that we could accidentally contaminate Mars with things that come from the Earth?
NASA, as well as other spacefaring nations, have pretty rigorous rules about cleanliness so that we don't contaminate the bodies we're going to visit. For us, it's particularly important that we have very meticulous cleanliness so that we don't go all the way to Mars and just analyze organic molecules we brought all the way with us.
So when are you hoping that touchdown dates are going to be, and when will experimentation start?
We expect to touch down towards the end of May 2008. We'll have to check out the spacecraft and exercise the robotic arm and make sure they know how to dig and things like that. So it'll be some while before we actually get to the point of doing our first analysis.
Bill Boynton from the University of Arizona. Back to Earth now, and there's new evidence that the in vitro approach may be a better way to test the safety of drugs and chemicals, Richard.
Well, talking just in the realm of toxicology, Chris, which is when you use animals to check chemicals that they're not harmful to human beings, there's actually been quite an explosion in the number of non-animal tests being validated for use by regulators to check chemicals. And ECVAM, which is the European Centre for the Validation of Alternative Methods, has validated 30 in vitro tests now. That's tests on cell lines in a test tube instead of using an animal. 14 in the last 18 months, and they expect 40 more by 2009.
How can we be sure that this isn't missing something? How can we be sure that this is a good representation of what would go on if this was a human body?
Well, you might think that animal tests are the best chance we've got of working out what's going on in the human body, but actually, Thomas Hartung, who is the head of ECVAM, says that 30% of pharmaceuticals fail in human trials because of a toxicological effect that wasn't picked up by the battery of animal tests they were subjected to. In fact, most people do agree that animal tests to check the safety of a chemical are simply not very predictive of what's going on in a human.
Could look at it the other way, that 60% of tests are successful in animals. What are we going to do to replace that 60% that's picked up at the moment?
The alternative tests are actually subjected to much higher regulatory controls than the animal tests they're going to replace. So in that way, just looking at the numbers, you can say that the alternative tests are better science.
So the way that it looks like it's all going, we're going to be replacing animals with dishes in the near future, and we're happy that they're a good representation of what goes on in a real person.
Yeah, that's the conclusion of an official US National Research Council report just released in June, and it says we are going to concentrate on human biology, not on animal biology, to check for toxicology testing. Of course, that doesn't account at all for the animals used in basic research or used by scientists to develop drugs. Toxicology testing, only 10% of the 10.7 million animals used in Europe every year, but a very important figure.
And I suppose one other spin-off of this is the fact that we can now build quite good computer models, in silico models of physiological systems, which enables you to test things without actually going near even a dish.
Exactly. In fact, in silico models were, of course, created by the pharmaceutical companies who want to save money by chucking out the drugs that are obviously toxic. They're actually not really quite good enough for the strict controls required by regulations, even though pharmaceutical companies use them all the time. But no doubt we'll see more of those models. And it's interesting that the real explosion of interest in this kind of thing has come now that the new European chemicals legislation is requiring 30,000 chemicals to be checked and re-evaluated for their safety. That would have caused 38 million animals to have to be tested under toxicology regulation. And as people are realising the enormous costs of that, they brought that down to a predicted 8 million animals now, which is still a lot, but has really pushed along efforts to develop alternative tests.
Thanks, Richard. Now, James, talking about drugs, they usually come in eighths, but now it's time to modernise and talk about kilos.
Well, that's right. Scientists are looking to redefine the kilo with an incredibly accurate new value. At the moment, the International Bureau of Weights and Measures in Paris holds in their vaults a chunk of platinum-iridium alloy, which by definition is a kilogram. Then they want to replace that with a physical constant definition.
What's wrong with the current kilo sitting in Paris?
Well, the current kilo is about 130 years old, and there's evidence that it is slowly but surely drifting in mass over time.
Gaining weight as it ages, like humans?
Yeah, but not quite as much as humans. We're still talking a few micrograms, but still, when you're talking about the sort of accuracy that you need to define the kilogram, all analytical tools around the world are calibrated against this one particular kilogram, so you need to know exactly how much it weighs.
So what are they suggesting we do instead?
So what they want to do is define the kilogram based on a particular number of silicon 28 isotope atoms, which would relate mass to the Avogadro's constant. The trouble is the Avogadro constant is not currently known to the levels of accuracy that you need to be able to redefine the kilogram. So at the 21st General Conference for Weights and Measures, held in Paris in 1999, they decided that any new definition of the kilogram must be accurate to one part in 10 to the 8 to be eligible.
So the kilo is not going to die a death yet then? I mean, it's going to take a little while before we redefine this baby.
Yeah, it's going to take a little while just because the process of redefining the Avogadro constant, which they're trying to achieve using these incredibly pure spheres of silicon 28, is just going to take a little while to do because they have to be perfectly spherical.
This has been the biggest challenge, really, that when you're trying to work out Avogadro's number, which is basically just a multiplier to turn the weight of a single atom into how many of those atoms you need to weigh a certain amount, actually pinning that down is really tricky. In the case of making these pure silicon spheres, they're making it out of silicon 28. That means if you count the number of protons and neutrons in its nucleus, there's 28 of them. And if you multiply that by Avogadro's number, that Avogadro's number is the number of atoms that you need to make 28 grams of silicon 28. The way that they've actually purified this stuff is absolutely torturous, and it relies on the same process that you use to purify and enrich nuclear fuel. It uses a gas centrifuge. What they do is take silicon, and that's a mixture of silicon 28 and 29 and 30, and they turn it into silicon fluoride, which is a gas, and they spin that gas incredibly fast. It separates out the heavier silicon atoms from the lighter silicon atoms. You funnel off the ones that you want, you convert it into silicon hydride, silane, and then finally to pure silicon. In milling these spheres, they're about the size of a softball, but they're spherical to within an accuracy of about 35 nanometers. That's 35 billionths of a meter.
Why do they have to be spheres?
The reason they have to be spheres is because they're looking at the arrangement of atoms within this sphere. If you get a perfect sphere, it's very easy to work out the number of atoms in it, the precise volume of it, and thus work out exactly how many atoms there are in that lump of material. And once you've got that, you relate it to its weight, and that's how you can tie in the mass of the object with the number of atoms to work out Avogadro's numbers so precisely.
Sounds like painstaking work. Thanks, Mark. Now, back to this month's chemical conundrum.
Hello, I'm Ben from Wolverhampton. I'd just like to ask, why is it that wood changes colour as it ages?
Well, indeed, a colourful question. Here's the answer.
My name is Clemens Altana. I'm a wood scientist at the University of Glasgow and work in the chemistry department. The question is, why does wood become darker when it ages? Basically, all wood cell walls are made out of three polymers. One is lignin, one is cellulose, and the other is comprised as hemicellulose. The polysaccharide cellulose and hemicellulose are white molecules, but the lignin has some chromatophoric groups in its structure, so it basically causes the brown color in wood. When wood is cut, a new surface is exposed to the environment. So as it happens, lignin is not only colored, but it's also UV active. So when UV light shines on the wood, it absorbs the energy, and it causes the lignin molecule to degradate and to form radicals, especially if there's some oxygen and water involved. What happens is basically that more chromatophoric groups are introduced in the lignin molecule, and that's why it becomes darker. You will see that, for example, in parquet, if you lay parquet in your house, it becomes a yellowish color. What might be also of interest is that paper is made out of wood pulp, and there are two different types of pulp. In one pulp, the lignin is removed, and paper made out of such lignin-free pulp is basically office paper. If you put that into the sunlight, it normally stays white. But there's another way to make pulp. It's just degrading wood at high moisture and high temperature, and then the lignin basically stays inside, and it is bleached. That means that chromatographic groups in the lignin are just destroyed. If you use that sort of paper, mainly newspapers are made out of that, and put it in the sunlight, it quite quickly becomes yellow.
Thanks to Clemens Altana for that answer. Well, that was pretty hard, but next month's question is a real headache.
Hi, this is Dave from Cambridge. Why does the hair of the dog work as a hangover cure?
Now, I wonder why he wants to know that. Well, if you can help, then please drop us a line to chemistryworld@rsc.org. And you can also use that address if you'd like to send us any feedback about this or one of our previous podcasts. Well, that's it for this month, which was produced by Azzy Kateri and presented by me, Chris Smith, from thenakedscientists.com, with Chemistry World's editor Mark Peplow and science correspondents Victoria Gill, James Mitchell Crow, and Richard Van Norden. For more science in the meantime, do check out the Chemistry World website at chemistryworld.org. I'll be back next month. Until then, goodbye.